just sit here and guess. When I fall from grace, you better look at yourself and see the faults within, and tell the wrongs from right. For we are all, we are all.
Hello and welcome to In The Mood For Podcast with Callum Reid of UltimateAddict.com and Pete Shepherd of InTheMoodForBlog.blog.co.uk. It
gets funnier every time you say it.
I think I'm getting better.
You are.
It's flowing better anyway.
Yeah.
This week we've got an actress special.
Indeed.
Lots of women to talk about.
Always.
While we're trying to recover from the England setback.
The debacle
in the
that was
football.
England. Yeah. And while we're just doing a sports digression, congratulations to the Miami Heat for winning the NBA finals.
Yeah.
That was hardly unexpected. Some of us made money on it.
How much did you make?
I put on a fiver and I got, I think it was £7.20. So I got them when they were about 29-20 or something like that, which, considering they got all the better players, wasn't too bad.
Was that before the entire series? No,
that was before game one, pre-game one, because they didn't have home advantage. That's what the only reason they were outsiders.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I won't pretend to know anything about baseball.
I know, or basketball, even.
But.
Yes. Oh, we can get into a rather delightful conversation about my fancy baseball team, but I think that's another one for another day.
Yeah, maybe when there's not so many releases out.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to start by talking about the new film by Joe Wright, director of Atonement, and it's an adaptation of Leo Tolstoy's book Anna Karenina, and here's a clip of the new trailer.
I must warn you about something.
Warn me?
You may, by indiscretion, give the world occasion to talk about you.
This must stop. If you have any thought for me, you will give me back my peace.
There can be no peace for us. Only misery. My greatest happiness.
Oh, there is none.
We are bound together by God, and this can only be broken by a crime against God.
So, what do you make of the Anna Karenina trailer?
Well, I think whenever you have something like this, you need like full disclosure at the beginning. And I love the book, absolutely adore the book. I did it for my A-levels, so lots of personal investment in that one.
Yeah.
And the first thing, which this happens with every single adaptation of Anna Karenina, and I don't think it's necessarily going to happen here, but in the trailer there's like nothing, there's like two things on the Levin Kitty storyline, and Anna Karenina is actually in two halves. But whenever they do the film, they always ditch the Levin Kitty half of the story and then just focus in on the Anna Karenina one, which is her and Vronsky. She has an affair with a young cavalry officer, and so there's always like compare and contrast things going on between the two. Specifically with this, so that is a little worrying that they just ditched it for the trailer, but I do kind of get why, because they've got to sell the Anna side of it because that's where all the stars are. The word came out about 2 or 3 months, maybe more, like maybe even longer ago, but I heard it about 2 or 3 months ago that it was going to be an experimental style to the storytelling.
Yeah.
And there is a shot in the trailer that particularly does show that. It's, you see a piano being played, then the camera sweeps around to the right, and then the doors come back, and then beyond the doors is an ice rink, and it's literally using the staging, you're going from an interior straight into an exterior, which isn't real. It's more like what you'd have in a dream, where you go in when you have like the interior of a house, and you're in the house, you're having the dream, then you open the door and go into the back garden, and then it's a back garden from somewhere completely different that you know. So it's right. Just sort of sweeps from one to the other. And I don't necessarily mind that. I think you've got to do something interesting with the presentation, because this is a very overdone story. It's been adapted a lot of times.
Yeah, and I think if there's anything Joe Wright can do, it's kind of modernise it the way he did with Pride and Prejudice.
And stylise it as well.
Yeah.
The casting on paper is almost like he's trying to ruin it.
Well, it's young, isn't it? He's gone for young.
Well, he's gone for young, but then there's random things with that. Like, Kelly MacDonald is supposed to be the same age-ish as Anna Karenina, yet she's a lot older than Kira is. She must be about, what?
10 years?
Yeah, ish. Maybe not as much. And so then, because she's supposed to be she's Anna's sister-in-law, so she's supposed to be around about the same age, maybe even younger, but around about the same age. And then with Kitty, who's the she's like a 17-year-old debutante who goes out there, and she's originally in love with Vronsky, but then Vronsky is the traditional Jane Austen cad and just ditches her and then goes and chases after Anna. And so she's been played by Alicia Vikander, who we talked about in A Royal Affair, the Danish film.
Yeah.
And she's 23, so I think with Joe Wright, the casting, he just casts who he wants. I think he uses the age thing as an excuse to cast the leads and then does whatever.
I think at this point it depends on whether you trust him.
Yes.
From previous films.
Mm.
See, I'd be inclined to trust him based on... I mean, the only one of his films I didn't like was The Soloist.
Yep.
But he seems to do very well with actors.
Mm. Yeah, oh, he gets the best out of them. Yeah, the thing with the original Kira Pride and Prejudice, I thought the trailer was awful, and the trailer was the reason I didn't go and see it in the cinema. So I wasn't when I saw this trailer, I was thinking, oof, that's a bit stagey, that's a bit posy from Kira, that's a bit over the top there. But the thing is, so I don't particularly like the trailer.
It's very
in the way it's selling the film, but I don't mind that with him, because I've seen a bad trailer from him before, or a trailer that I didn't like before, and I end up really liking Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, so, I mean, I would imagine this is more Atonement than Pride and Prejudice. It just seems more Seamus McGarvey kind of putting on all the stops.
Yeah, I mean, it looks... I mean, the production values and the cinematography look absolutely fantastic. The art direction, costumes, the lot. I'm not sold on the hair. Some of Kira's hairdos, but I think if they're going in that sort of the way we were talking about with the style of the shifting between scenes, it's quite avant-garde, really.
Well, are they gonna try and make her look older? Because the way the trailer makes it seem, it's more like kind of Scarlett O'Hara.
Mm.
Like she's like at one point she's wearing black, and that makes me think that that's like later on, and she's like the way Vivian does.
Yeah, I think. With the problem with judging this in the trailer is that they've got to put the bigger bits in, be it bigger bits from her, be it bigger bits from the wow, to get the wow factor to make people think this is a big sprawling epic. So you're not going to be doing like the you're not going to have scenes of like a bit of people in rooms talking just quietly. You're going to have the ball scene in the trailer. You're going to have shots of the palaces and what have you. And it's all very well and good.
Do you know if the piano is Dario Marianelli?
Cause it might be. It could. Well, it sounds Rachel Portmanish as well. It could be either. Because he used Portman for Pride and Prejudice, and then Marianelli for.
No, I think
Atonement.
Was Marianelli not Pride and Prejudice? I think he did.
I'm
something.
Not sure.
But wonderful anyway. I really like
it. Yes, yeah, lovely music. But I do think it suits the piece. It adds to all the sort of sweepingness of it all. But I think that's just the way he's going to do it. He is a self-confessed show off.
Yeah, I mean we didn't talk about the Great Gatsby trailer, but it's very
you're right, it was Marinelli.
Yeah, it's very full pelt. You know, he's gone all out, so I mean, you may as well. You want people to see it, don't you? So
yeah,
just
everything
in there.
I mean, this is the prestige thing of the year, the British prestige film of the year, so you've got to do it. The with Kira, I'm every apprehension that I had beforehand with the casting is confirmed in this trailer, but I'm still willing to give her the benefit of the doubt.
He got a great performance out of her in Pride and Prejudice, in my view, but Atonement is a different story.
Yeah, I think the different approaches to each, and I don't think they neither. I don't think either necessarily transfers across to a role as difficult and as nuanced as Anna Karenina.
Is she not? I think, is she not ready at this stage of her career?
This is why they always cast actresses in their 30s and age cast down from there.
Mm.
It's because you really do need you need an experienced actress to be able to handle it.
But I did. Have you seen Last Night? The film
No. Well, I think the one with Guillaume Canet.
Yeah. Well, she's really good in that, Kira. It's probably her best performance.
Mm.
Just and more grown up, you know, yeah. Which made me a little more encouraged going into this. But
I think what Wright did, my take on what Wright did with her in Pride and Prejudice was every scene where they took the drama as much as they could. So if she's got, they'd have her getting in Darcy's face. They'd have her shouting whenever she's supposed to be refusing him. She's refusing a gentleman of £10,000. She's shouting in his face. I mean, it's just it gets a good performance.
Yeah.
And in each individual scene, but I think with this, it is Anna Karenina is a detailed slide into madness, rather like say something like Iris. For Judi Dench is a detailed slide into mental degradation.
Yeah,
it's that kind of thing. And the trickiest part with that is she's still got to be sweet and charming while all that's happening, because that's the character. So she can't be the sort of like placid, just posy, faceless, like face for depression
in the
like,
Duchess. Like,
yeah, yeah, or in little bit, or the sort of. Certain parts of Atonement. I think she was fine in Atonement, but I didn't think she really had anything to do in Atonement. I think that was McAvoy's film.
Yeah.
And, But, yeah, so it's not convinced. None of those, like, line readings are convincing me that it's going to be anything revelatory. But, yeah, but it's. Everything's out of context, and that's the whole point of Anna. The thing for Kira that will make her good or not is how it is from scene to scene, and if it's like a Al Pacino in Insomnia, where throughout the whole film he's going to get gradually tireder, and that's going to gradually affect his mental state. You see, these are the sort of people who do these sort of roles that I'm mentioning. I'm mentioning Dench. I'm mentioning Pacino. it's that kind of thing. It is the role of a lifetime. It's far more demanding than Pride and Prejudice. Lizzie Bennet may be the best role because that's a role that any young actress would have, and it's a role that a lot of actresses can show what they can do in. This one is more like passing the bar exam.
This is huge.
this is the exam. This isn't the bit to show what you can do. This is the utmost test of an actress in that age group. And let's not pretend that Garbo's version was good. It wasn't. Vivien Leigh's version wasn't good.
There haven't been any good versions of this.
There have, but nothing in the public consciousness. The Russians did one with the woman from The Cranes Are Flying in the mid 60s.
Yeah.
Which I've only seen, this you'll love this. I've only seen with Americans dubbing it.
What?
In no subtitles. The only copy I could find anywhere. It was an American dubbed version, but I still liked it a lot. And it was like 2.5 hours long. The one really good version is the BBC 70s miniseries with Nicola Paget and Stuart Wilson as Vronsky, and an absolutely brilliant Eric Porter as the husband Karenin.
I'm not sure what the running time is for this, but
it's going to be key, because if it's in 2 hours, you're going to have to butcher the Levin Kitty,
right?
And I think you ideally you'd have three.
His films have all been around two, haven't they?
I think ideally you'd have three. I'd hope it would be at least a Dave Fincher 145. I think that's the minimum you could do it really well in, because to do it really well, you've got to have some of Levin and Kitty's storyline to balance out what's happening in Anna and Vronsky's storyline.
You think they give him that long?
I think he could have whatever he wants, but it depends on. It's Tom Stoppard who's adapted it, so it really does depend. I mean, I know what you're saying. It's the production companies always want this view as short of runtime as possible, so they can get more showings.
He might have Final Cut, I don't know.
I would, if I was him, I'd hope so.
Yeah.
I would have thought he's got enough of a reputation to have earned it, but and it's not a Hollywood thing. It's not a big time Hollywood. So I'd hope so, but you never know. It might be a 2-hour job, and in that case, then you're just judging it on how well they execute whatever they've got, because there's only so much you can put into 2 hours, and there are a lot of set pieces in this. There's a horse race about 100 pages, because Anna Karenina's 800 pages long. There's a very important horse race, 100 pages in, which is going to be really cinematic, and I can't wait to see what he does with it, because every single Anna Karenina thing makes a big deal out of the horse racing scene.
Yeah.
And Joe Wright is going to want to top every single
one
of them.
Yeah, he will do.
So right there, you've got 5-10 minutes that's not actually going to be even touching much of the plot, but it's going to be Joe Wright doing his Joe Wright thing. And I'd hope so.
So, what do you think about Kira's Oscar chances?
I think they're fair. I think when you consider that she didn't get a BAFTA nomination for Pride and Prejudice, but she did get Oscar nominated, and it was the other way round with Atonement. She did get BAFTA nominated, and she didn't get Oscar nominated. I think the reason she didn't get BAFTA nominated for Pride and Prejudice was because there's such a frame of reference in this country for the character, because it's the nation's favourite book, and because the BBC miniseries was so legendary. That's not the case here, because the 70s BBC Anna Karenina isn't legendary. Nobody knows it. So that's going to be a lot better for her.
Yeah, but do you not think there's a general lack of respect for her as an actress in this country compared to abroad?
Certainly. Yeah, I think there's not much of a question on that one. But that's because the British tend to knock people off perches and be cynical in general. But this, if she does well with this, that'll shut everyone up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. if you do well with this, and then there's nothing else to say. I mean, I already think she was good as Lizzie. She wasn't my Lizzie Bennet, but I think she was a good Lizzie Bennet, and I think she was good in there was a Gillies McKinnon film, Pure, where she played a drug addict waitress. Around the same time, she did Pirates of the Caribbean. She's very good, and that's she's got some talent. It's just a question of harnessing it, and I do think Joe Wright in the past has harnessed it well.
Yes.
It's just with the Oscars, I think she's got a fair chance, because it is such a difficult role. It could go wrong quite drastically, but it also depends on how well the film is received as a whole. I think, rather like Atonement, this is the sort of thing that would carry people along, rather than being standout for the acting and then the film comes along as
an afterthought. Yeah, I can see this more as a craft hall,
yes,
than anything else. Just maybe it's the young cast that I don't know, people seem to devalue films with a younger, more inexperienced cast.
Do you think Kira's locked, or do you think likely?
I think a decent bet at the moment, definitely. They've nominated her before, so I don't see why they wouldn't again, and nobody's ever been nominated for this role.
No. That, well, yes. I also think that a lot of that's to do because the films weren't very good. And the Marceau one in the 90s didn't make a dent. But that was pretty. That got gutted. Yeah, I think they cut about 40 minutes out of that.
Ouch.
And so that got that. Yeah. So even when you're not going to have it that long to begin with. So when you're doing that, you're on a hiding to nothing.
Yeah. I've seen a couple of other contenders. Have you seen the Shadow Dancer trailer?
No.
Andrea Riseborough.
Yes.
It's very like she's. It's a bit like In the Name of the Father.
Oh right.
So she's kind of this IRA. I think she's like an informant, but I only think she's an informant because her family's got mixed up in it or something.
Right. Oh, okay. I've got you. I see where you're getting the vibe from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she's been doing very well. She sticks out in bad stuff, and I was more thinking Brighton Rock.
Right.
Well, not that Brighton Rock's bad. I just don't think it's good. But so she seems to be quite bulletproof with the critics, even when she's doing films that they don't like. So if she comes along and does one that they do like, then they're going to go. And she had a lot of people. Kermode adored her in WWE.
Yeah.
And whoever reviewed it in the Times, I'm not sure if it was Kate Muir or Wendy Eyed, they really liked her as well. I mean, all I heard about was the film's awful and she's brilliant.
Yeah. And the costumes.
yes.
You haven't seen The Hunger Games, right?
No, I wanted to, but I haven't. I'd be surprised, quite honestly, if it had that kind of legs, because online, people aren't talking about it that much. It's not that sort of rabid Dark Knight type thing.
Yeah, I would be more inclined to say that if I hadn't seen her, because yeah. I think she stands out a lot, and it's not so teeny, it's not very Twilight, so I think maybe if it's a weak year she's got a chance, because I think she will get nominated again.
Yes. It always comes down to, it's not about who's good, it's not about that, it's purely about who gets campaigned by who.
Yeah.
It's very little of it is to do with you can have things that on paper look absolutely unmess upable, like Lizzie Olsen in Martha, Marty, May, Marlene. I mean, there is literally a formula which you can follow to get an Oscar nomination, and they didn't do it.
It still surprises me that didn't get more.
It's the Sundance launch pad, and then you get the DVDs sent out in like as early as possible, early October. You're the first DVD in their hands, so when nobody else is sending them, they're gonna stick it in the DVD player and have a look, and then you campaign it for about 6 weeks to get the nomination, because you're not gonna win
with tiny films like that. Yeah,
so there's a method to it, and they didn't do it because they had to. I think it was Fox Searchlight had that and Margaret, and they had too many films, and they had The Tree of Life and they had The Descendants, and those are your big two, and then you can only really afford, and they're going all categories, you can only afford to push one more, and they chose Fassbender and Shane, and I kind of get why.
Yeah, but definitely.
Yeah. I do get why, but they had a couple. Paquin, if they'd have pushed that.
Yeah.
Dot.
If. That's coming out in a couple of weeks, isn't it? On DVD.
Yes. Can't wait for that. Okay, so.
I think we better move on, shall we?
Yeah, we are. From a couple of weeks to this week, and we're going to have our first of two new releases that we've both seen. 5-Year Engagement.
Yes.
Which is Jason Segel's new film, which I realised that he'd written without seeing the credits, because he wears an old suit in The Muppets, and he wears an old suit in this. And so as soon as I saw him in the old suit, I thought, you've written this, haven't you, Sam?
That's not the bunny suit, right?
No, the other suit. The vintage suit. Do you remember the vintage suit?
When's that?
Towards right at the end.
Oh, okay, yeah.
When he's... Yeah. Okay. do you want to give a rundown of the plot for this one?
Yeah. Okay. Basically, it's produced by Judd Apatow, directed by Nicholas Stoller, who did Forgetting Sarah Marshall and Get Him to the Greek. And... it's starring Emily Blunt and Jason Segel. It's about an engaged couple who move from San Francisco to Michigan for the sake of the girlfriend's career in psychology, and from there the relationship deteriorates rapidly.
Succinct. Right. I saw this tonight. When did you see this one?
I saw it on Friday.
Friday, so you've had a weekend to digest it. I've had about 2 hours. I didn't like it.
Really?
I've got to say, I didn't like it. And my main reason for not liking it was Blunt. She was just chipmunk fake smiling the whole way through. I didn't think they had any chemistry. And I wasn't laughing. And I did laugh in like the last half hour or so. But it's 2 hours long. And it felt long for me. And it took a long time to get going.
It's a knocked up syndrome, isn't it?
Yeah.
These films are a bit long. I mean,
yeah, they take far too long to execute the plot setup. This is at least 25 minutes before they actually get the "she's got a job in Michigan."
Yeah.
Thing.
The beginning is really funny. Do you not think, with the engagement party? And the reminded song me of, that he makes, and the girl crying.
Yeah, that, yeah, Scott Hatterberg. Scott Hatterberg was funny in this film. And for anyone listening there, that's the actor played the Oakland Athletics first baseman in Moneyball. So that's why I'm calling him Scott Hatterberg. The
Chris
best friend.
Pratt.
Yes, he was funny. He was amusing. He didn't make me laugh at that, but it was amusing. But I think remember the speech off in Bridesmaids between Rose Byrne and Kristen Wiig, where they're each trying to top each other, and it goes on a bit too long, and you're just thinking, okay, get on with it. I was kind of like that, where you got all these embarrassing things after a while. Chris Pratt's was the funny, was the amusing one, but then the rest of it wasn't really feeling it.
I was refreshed to find, because it is formulaic, it's admittedly formulaic, but still, it has a lot of interesting touches. Like, I think the Sesame Street conversation is
brilliant.
You can
tell that's written by Americans. That is good, but there's no way two British women have that conversation.
But it is in a British film.
I know, but they're British characters. I mean, they've even got an American. The girl playing the sister is an American. She's on Mad Men, and
Alison Brie.
Yeah, and apparently to get the accent, she had Blunt read her lines into a voice recorder. So she was basically copying Blunt's voice. So there's no way a British character would have a conversation, but it was good. That was. You don't see, it was sly. It's a twist on, instead of just having the massive conversation, it's a bit cleverer than you'd usually see.
I think that they have chemistry, Blunt and Siegel, and I think they are convincing as a couple. I think, I don't know, it feels like the relationship's well formed. Like when they split up, I was actually bothered.
Oh, I wasn't. It's the thing. And they immediately go and drop off to like colleagues or people that they already knew.
That killed
any romance that there might have been. I mean, because the thing with this, you've got to give it a lot of goodwill, because they're a couple when you see when the film starts. They're already a couple, and they're already in love, and they're getting married, and they want to get married. There's not going to be any backstory to that. There's a backstory of like how they first met. But then everything else is taken as read, and you've got to go along with that and accept that these two are meant to be together, or it's not going to work. Where they go with it?
Yeah, I mean, it's got the like crazy thing where they both go off with different people.
Yeah, that was a bit like crazy. Yeah,
I'm not sure she would have gone off with him.
No, it's just.
I think that's. Fence.
I think yeah. I think that's why where you were saying it's formulaic. That's what's. That is the sort of trite thing you've seen before, where we've got to separate them. I didn't necessarily mind that as much as him. Just it was like they introduced a character earlier on. She's in one scene, and then as soon as there's a question of Reese Iffens maybe getting together or not, he immediately goes, and then suddenly she appears out of nowhere, and I groaned because I just thought. Oh, why? Where's she come from? And you know why she's there immediately.
Yeah.
Because you haven't seen her before. The only thing I really actively disliked about this film, really, really got my hackles up, was there's a scene, and there are various funerals throughout the film, and it's part of a running joke that they've got to get married in time, or the grandparents are going to start dying.
I like
he
that.
Goes. He. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think. Yeah. That was. You can tell these guys wrote the Muppets, the film version of the Muppets, because the Muppets. It's a similar humor where they'll have a line and it's a cut to, and then you've got a visual. Siegel and the director both did the screenplay for the Muppets. There's at one of the funerals. He's trying to get back in Blunt's good graces. He turns up, even though they're not together. At the grandparents' funeral, how emotionally manipulative is that? What kind of scum are you that you're going to abuse this poor girl's emotional state? And not that they even show any emotional state. The only thing that you see in Blunt is that she's wearing a black dress.
The subtext
really annoyed me. There, I was just thinking, wait, what? You're trying to get back with a girl, and so you're going to go to her grandparents' funeral. No, that's just... you can see how much the film had lost me that I was thinking in those terms.
I thought, well, he wouldn't turn up there, but then he... But then he explains that
he'd been close
or whatever.
Yeah, well, this is the relationships between her and his mate and her sister are very incestuous, so it is explainable, if not pardonable. Let's put it that way. His behaviour.
The only thing that I was a bit upset with was that the kind of like portray of Michigan as this complete.
Hole.
Yeah, and it's like a complete opposition between that and San Francisco, and I'm just Michigan people out there.
Yeah, they have to tread a thin line because they're showing him as giving up his career for her, and then they actually have characters point out, stop being a martyr, and then she feels guilty that she's got her career, and he's unhappy.
Are there no decent restaurants in Michigan?
I know. Well, none that he can get a job at, apparently, with his CV. and then they show her feeling guilty about having this, and then she gets told, stop wallowing. And it's a fine line between pointing out what if the audience is already thinking this, then the pointing it out either goes, oh, okay, I get it, they're supposed to be doing that, or... You think, yes, I know they're doing that. And I was very much the latter, because I'd already been thinking, stop being such a bloody martyr. For about at least half an hour before they actually point it out. And that's the thing. It's the whole if you're going along with it or not. It's if you respond to the way it's being acted and the characters, then you're gonna go along with it a lot more.
Yeah, I think it's the Apatow way of making kind of splitting up men and women, because I think men would have a much different opinion of like the couple than women would, and it's the same situation in Knocked Up where he's on the fantasy baseball team, he's sneaking away.
That was one of the bits I did actually like about Knocked Up quite a bit. That is quite realistic.
So this was not... Is this a 5 out of 10?
Maybe a 4. I think I did actively dislike it. This is the thing we've said before. For me, 5 is average. So 4 isn't a terrible score, but it just means I didn't like it.
Okay.
If I didn't like something, I can't give it more than 4. And I'm giving this 4 because it did in the last half hour or so. I did start laughing more. I did start getting into it more. But by that point, for me, it was a bit too little, a bit too late.
Right. Well, this may be coming up next week. at some point.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So moving on very quickly, because I don't want to give it too much of my or your intellectual time.
Okay.
Is a Russian film called Silent Souls, which I had the misfortune to see. This it's a film, and it's only about 70 minutes long or so. I have no idea how it's got released, because there's no name stars. It was shown at the Venice Film Festival a couple of years ago, and
it was well reviewed.
I'm sure it was. Well reviewed in the way that films are at film festivals when there's nothing happening and some cinematography. So the basic setup of this is that a guy's who's a photographer, his boss, his wife has died the night before. They live in the backwards part of Russia, where it's all the old customs are dying. These people are like really out of the loop, and he wants them to, because she's died, he doesn't want the police, he doesn't want them to be involved, he doesn't want the undertakers to come. He wants to dispose of the body in the traditional way that their people do, and so the boss gets this photographer guy to help him execute the what needs to be done to send her off in the traditional way. And the problem with this is that
it sounds happy.
There's very little characterization, and part of the ritual is that you have to talk about all the dirty things you used to do in bed with them, with the person who's died, because that when, by doing that, you're going to have the memory, and then it will light up your face, and it's the only time in the mourning process that you'll. So they do cut out of it quite quickly, but it's just, it's really emotionally arctic at that point. So it really stops you from getting on board with like what the character's going through in terms of grief, because they've just been gits. And so they basically have to go to some water and burn the body in a certain way, and prepare the body in a certain way beforehand. And they don't miss any chance to show off full frontal female nudity whenever they can. It's another one of those type films.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of one of my favourite films, which... which deals with a ritual that needs to be done, which is Zhang Yimou's The Road Home, where the reason that film is so impactful emotionally is because it's only half of the story. The story there is that a guy comes back from Beijing, I think it's Beijing, and he's got to walk his grandfather's body home. That's the ritual, and so half of it is him doing that, because the grandmother insists, and then the other half is them in the 50s, the grandmother and the grandfather. The grandmother's played by Zhang Ziyi, and so by seeing how they were together, it really underpins everything emotionally when you actually see. And I completely lost it watching The Road Home. When they actually start doing it, because you start thinking about not necessarily because of the character, but you start thinking about your grandparents or what have you, and it just you lose it with this, because it's just the rituals, and there's nothing emotional to underpin it. The only emotion is that he's got some birds that he's bought, and he's taking them along in the car because he doesn't want them to starve. That's about as caring as any of the characters get.
Right.
And so I really got no. It's like 75 minutes long. It's. It's sparse. It's a sparse film. There's a lot of shots of, like, in the back of a car where nothing's happening apart from the birds tweeting in the cages for a couple of minutes. I just really wonder why anyone thought this would have some even minimal appeal on the art house circuit. And that's pretty much.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the type of film that would get released.
No, nothing of note. It's not. I mean, some of these grim. Style based films can have really fantastic performances, but I don't think that's the case here. I think it's all very minimalistic, and so for me there's very, very little on offer, and I couldn't really recommend it to anyone.
Oh dear.
Indeed.
Onwards and upwards.
Onwards and upwards. The Last Projectionist, which is a documentary about the Electric Cinema in Birmingham, which is one of the cinemas I go to. And it's directed by the owner of the Electric Cinema in Birmingham, a guy called Tom Laws, who also shot the film, edited the film, did the music for the film. And according to the Q&A, I went to the gala screening with a lot of people involved in the film in attendance in the cinema that it's about. And he said that it was made for £10,000. This documentary that's made for £10,000, and it's on 30 screens in the country at the moment.
That's good, considering.
That is good. That was my question, by the way. How many screens is it on?
Did did he say how he got the funding?
No, I think it was
lottery.
But he did say how he bought the cinema, which isn't in the film, which is an interesting little tale. It was sold at auction, and it was going to be turned into a nightclub. But it was £2,000 below the reserve. The highest bid was £2,000 below the reserve. He'd only found out it was going to be sold the day before, so he went down to the bank and tried to get got a deposit advance on a loan. Didn't buy it on the thing. Then negotiated over the upcoming months with the person who owned it, and ended up buying it for the exact same amount that failed at the auction.
So it was. Is it a historic cinema?
Yes, it's the oldest working cinema in the country.
And it was going to be turned into a nightclub.
Yes, and it's changed hands multiple times. It's changed styles multiple times. So in the 30s, it was basically a newsreel cinema. So they'd go in and you'd have like on every hour on the hour you have news and cartoons. In 50s, it was more cartoon based, and this my dad knows it as basically a porn house. because so when The Bottom fell out of the industry in the 70s and 80s, that's the sort of film they showed, nudie flicks, and it still had that reputation. I first time I went there, I went to see Out of Sight, so that dates it. It was like 98, 99-ish. It was a late one. It was a few months after it had come out as well. It was probably early 99. And we went there, and me and this lad from school, and we thought we were going to die because it's in a really rough part of Birmingham. And we just wanted to get out of there so fast. We really enjoyed the film, but we really wanted to get out of there. And I parked my car in the middle of the where all the sex shops are. we just wanted to leave so much, but yeah. So he took over in 2004, and so what the film does is it chronicles the different changes, and it also and the background of that is there's a lot of local projectionists who work for various cinemas, telling stories, talking about the how film used to be, how it used to be working in cinemas, and how it is now. So if you're interested in the sort of workings of film in terms of cinemas and how they go about, it's an interesting watch. It's only 80 minutes.
Yeah.
It does feel a little bit of
a stretch.
No, I was going to say an advert.
Oh, right. Because, okay.
Because they go around a few other cinemas and you've got all these people talking about why independent cinemas are good and all this sort of thing. And when you're actually in that cinema watching that film about that cinema, it's it does feel like, well, I'm already here, you don't have to tell me how good it is.
We're preaching to the wrong crowd.
Yeah, but then you've got to remember that there's 30 other screens, and these people aren't in the cinema.
Well, you can't imagine that there's many. It's at any multiplexes, right?
This was part of the Q&A. Apparently, he ran into a Cannes when he was selling the film. He ran into the woman who's the head of Odeon. And she told him, send me a copy, and he did, and he hasn't heard a word from her since.
Oh dear.
I do think that because I've been going to that cinema for about 5 years, and I was actually in that cinema, it reminded me of how very specific circumstances of you watching a film can really affect your feelings towards it. For example, we've already gone over on this podcast that I'm not a fan of Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
The one time I enjoyed a Wes Anderson film was when I watched The Royal Tenenbaums at Glastonbury. So it was that kind of, shall we say, altered
context.
a context that was required for me to fully appreciate a Wes Anderson film. I do think for this, my being in that cinema while there's being the history shown of that cinema really did make it better than it would be, because there's an intrigue factor to it. You don't get that. It's just very strange. It's surreal. You're sat in that cinema watching a film about the history of that cinema, and you won't get that anymore. So that adds stuff.
Has it got universal appeal?
Well, I think if you are interested in like the nuts and bolts of workings of a cinema, like the people behind the scenes and how they're turned into profitable organisms. And all that sort of things, or not, and how they survive, and then how that goes against the context of what's going on in terms of the cinema, world cinema at the time. It's interesting, but I do think without that extra little push of that got me to enjoy it as much as I did, it is entertaining. It is funny. There's some real characters of the projectionists in there, but it's a bit of a tough ask. I don't think many people would be interested in this, but I think it does have a certain niche market, and.
If it's at 30 screens, it may well have made the budget back.
Well, this is the thing. I went there, and there's 100 seats in the Electric Cinema, and then they have a lot of couches that they sell for like £25 for two. You got waiter service. They've got a bar, and so I know that they'd sold 80. I know they sold 80 of the 100 normal seats, and say they've sold out and they had sold out all of the couches. Say that they had the 100 people in there. They're paying £7 a pop. That's £700. The budget was £10,000. I mean, if you have it for a week, you've made half the money, and you get that many people in there, you've got half the money.
Yeah.
Or you've almost got a tenth of it back. just purely on that one showing in that house, and that's all going to you because you're the producer and you own it. So you're not only getting that you're getting the producer money and the house money, you're getting everything from that's been everything from that cinema.
Yeah,
but it is interesting when you see stuff like the girl in the front of house who takes a day to learn how to do a digital projection. You just press download a film, press a button. That sort of thing's eye opening.
Yeah. So do they begin with the last projectionist?
They have like five or six of them in a pub in Birmingham, and there's like a round table, and they're having conversations. So they're telling stories about the old days, and then they're talking about like film versus digital. And that's what the sort of impending digital switch is brought up quite a bit. But they all seem to think that the sound now is just absolutely incredible, and you just can't argue with that side of it.
Yeah.
There's some people who prefer the digital now visuals, and some don't.
There's benefits to both, I think.
Yeah. Well, he was saying in the Q&A afterwards that... the irony of this film is that certain art houses wanted it, but even though this is a film that bemoans the lack of the switch to digital, it's only available in digital. to get the properly each print costs £1,000. To get the actual master proper print is £50,000, and the budget for this was £10,000.
Yeah,
it's not worth it. And their marketing budget was that he spent about £10,000 marketing it as well. So you can't spend £50,000 on one proper mastered print,
but that's obviously good for like indie filmmakers to get films made.
Exactly. But then on the flip side of it, he also said that there was a he was saying if the switch to digital costs a cinema, even though there's like initiatives that help them, it costs £50,000. And one of the cinemas that wanted the film, its yearly turnover was £50,000. So the maths don't add up. That cinema, as soon as it goes digital, that cinema's gone.
Yeah.
Because they just can't sustain it. So that's this is the thing. If this sort of thing that we've just been talking about, these sort of issues interest you, you'll like the film.
Yeah.
And it does have some laughs, and there's some nice little touches when they're going over in between the different time periods. They've got like animated sequences, and I think as a director, he meshes them in well, and they're not jarring. And there's a nice little style to it all, and it's very enjoyable, but probably more so because of the specific circumstances in which I watched it.
Okay.
Restarting the French Quarter, two French films, one of which is being shown the day that we're uploading this podcast. So if you're around the Midlands,
yeah, barring a power cut, yes.
yeah. If you're in the Midlands, it's on tonight, as in Tuesday, which is tomorrow night. We record this on Monday. It's Tomboy. It's from last year, about 18 months ago when it was released in France.
Yeah, I think.
And
so.
It was out here about 6 months ago.
Yes, and January, I think.
Do you want to run down the plot setup for this one?
Yeah, it's basically about a family as a single mother and two girls, and they've moved into this apartment, and it's about this girl's struggle with her gender identity. Somebody mistakes her for a boy because she has short hair and she doesn't correct them, and it's about how she interacts with the different kids in the neighbourhood. And
yeah, she becomes a sort of a tough guy. To overcompensate, or maybe it's because she's a tomboy and the film's called Tomboy, but she does really try and overcompensate.
She does look like a boy, kind of.
She does, and she likes to play football, and so she wants to join in with the boys, but obviously not with the when half of them are playing skins and the others are playing shirts.
Yeah. There isn't a father, is there?
I don't think so.
Is that an issue?
It's been a while since I saw I think psychologists would probably tell you so.
Yeah.
But then again, psychologists always try and blame everything on your parents. God forbid you actually take responsibility for who you are. Sorry. I think I might say what I really think if we carry on this. Yeah, I like this. This is by a woman called Celine Sciamma, who made her name with Water Lilies about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
A film which I really liked, and I think the direction was superb. And she does do the atmosphere of young girls and their awakening and maturing and sort of kicking on into puberty or beyond. She really does capture the atmosphere around that sort of magical, eerie, otherworldly atmosphere really well.
Yeah, it's a very tender. I like the interplay between the kids. I think it doesn't feel very forced or anything.
Yeah, it's a very honest film.
Yeah,
the acting. She does get good performances out of people who might not necessarily have worked before. The girl playing one of the girls. The plot is that one of the local girls falls for our tomboy.
Mm.
And it's very nice. It's very nicely played, and it could be so exploitative. Yeah. Because it's handled so honestly and delicately, and because it's all about the style. It's not, and that means they don't try. They try to do this artistically. They're not trying to do this for the sake of like, oh, the subject matter. They're not. This isn't a Gaspar Noé film. Where you're going to think, watch this film and you'll see a 10-year-old girl fall in love with another 10-year-old girl. That's not the selling point.
I think Gaspar Noé films are no kids allowed.
Yeah, and incidentally, the tone of this that it reminds me of is a French film called Innocence, which was by the woman who's with Gaspar Noé in real life. She was the director.
Wow.
Innocence is a 2004 film with Marion Cotillard, and it's a similar sort of awakening of a young girl.
So very different from him.
Yes, polar opposite. Mm. She's actually good.
Yeah. Yeah, this reminded me of Panette. It's probably the same kind of thing. You seen Panette?
Yes. Roland Polanski likes them young. He was the president of the Venice Film Festival when Victoire Thiebesold won Best Actress
at age 5 or something.
Something silly.
I can't argue.
And it took me years to. Yeah, I can't argue, and it took me years to actually realise she's the girl in Chocolat as well.
Yeah, where is she? Crazy. She must only be like 20 now.
Yeah, she girl needs to work. Girl needs to work. But yeah, I don't think the performance from Zoe Harin was as good as Victoria Thiebesold, but that's a really, really unfair comparison, and she is good.
Yeah.
I don't think there's much of a question about that one.
Definitely.
I don't think too many people are going to watch this and think, oh, that girl was really bad.
It's not like her. She's boyish, but you can imagine somebody trying to be more boyish, like more androgynous, and she's totally not like that.
Hmm. It's a very laid back performance. It's not a performy performance. See what you mean with this? She's not trying to force any of it. It's she is that character, and she doesn't have to go over the top to be boyish. Unless, I mean, she's just going to want to go and play football. It's just who she is, and that's why I really find it interesting about this, because it is a thing. I mean, you're doing can you imagine a film being done by Hollywood about this gender identity of a 10-year-old girl who likes to play football?
No.
And if it and then it'd probably be really hyper indie and marginalised, and like seven people had seen
Larry Clark.
Yeah. Or what was that one? What was it? I can't remember what it was called. Nothing is Private.
Mm.
Who's the guy who wrote American Beauty? Alan
Ball.
Yeah, the guy who did True Blood. I think he did a film, Nothing is Private, and it was about Aaron Eckhart getting together with a 14-year-old, and immediately, as soon as you hear anything like that, anything like controversial in that sort of subject matter, anything to do with sexual desire or anything like that with a young girl,
yeah,
out the window. But yes, so do check this out. I think it was one of the more interesting films of last year. Mm-hmm. And I'm pleased that it's still kicking around, and obviously it did well enough to merit another showing, even if it is just for one day.
Can't wait to see what she does next, Celine Sharma.
Yeah, yes, she's interesting. Right, so before we move on to the finale of Later Favourite, I'll just briefly do Angèle and Tony, which was I saw a few weeks ago, but is now at one of my independent cinemas, and now it's at another at the back end of this week. This is another French film. We're still in the French Quarter.
Last one, promise.
Yeah, it's the last one, yeah. Can I just say, as a quick aside on the French Quarter thing, I used to say quite often, that jokingly, that when you hear the words world cinema in Britain, that means in French, and I think you'll see why that joke still stands up, because French films just get so much more distribution than anything else, and there's so much more of it.
Well, they make more films really than anyone else, don't they?
Probably. I think so. Yeah. So this one is about a woman who's just been released from prison, and she's got a young son who's living with the father's grandparents. The father's not on the scene, and she is trying to get her son back. In the midst of this, she meets a local fisherman called Tony via a personal ad. They meet up in a cafe, and it comes she wants out of her job that's mandated by a parole officer. It's at the local factory. She wants to move, wants to fast track a relationship with somebody, anyone, just to get her life in order so she can get her son back. And it does a lot of things in terms of shorthand, it's not a long film, but it doesn't feel rushed.
Yeah.
It just breezes along really nicely, and the characters. It's more what's not said than what is. It's more subtext rather than just laying everything out there as if you're a 13-year-old watching a Christopher Nolan film.
This is happening way too often.
every week, but we'll be talking about him soon. Maybe we'll get around to that. Yeah, so the interesting aspects of this are that first scene in the film, she's having sex with a random guy in order to get a toy for her son. So it's that kind of, literally, she's using sex as currency. She doesn't care. So when she meets Tony, who's a bear of a man, and he's a fisherman, he obviously doesn't think very much of himself, low self-esteem, in the opposite way that she has low self-esteem. When she's trying to throw herself at him to try and like fast track the relationship, he doesn't want anything to do with it because his pride won't allow it, because it's for him sex is everything, for her it's just a means of getting what she wants. So when you put these two people together and they're trying to form a relationship, and it's very aloof because of him, I think that's very interesting. With where they go with it, I think towards the end they do rush it just a tad too much, so not in the execution but in the writing. But it's very well acted. It's Clotilde Desma. She was in Mysteries of Lisbon, and was one of the better, for that read, the only good thing in that film. And the guy playing Tony, I think he's in the La Comédie Française. He's good. I haven't seen him in anything before or noticed him in anything before. But yeah, really nice performance, subtle, restrained. I think the end doesn't. It's not as dramatically. It could have been more satisfactory, but you know why they've gone. They go in the direction that they do, because they want to show off one side of him, which hasn't been explored yet. I'm being very ambiguous there. but they could go in a very tight up in a nice little bow, but instead they shift it sideways a little bit and give a hint to something else that might happen in the future. So it's not ambiguous at all, but it's just it doesn't spoon feed you everything, that ending. So it's not the most satisfactory, but I understand why they've done it. And yeah, so if it's around, check it out. It's one of the better films from last year, and
this week.
Yes, and it is one of the better films from this week. Yes. So last up we have Lay the Favourites, yeah, which is the new Stephen Frears film. Stephen Frears of Dangerous Liaisons, The Queen, and The Grifters fame.
Yes.
You or me for the rundown?
Yeah, go for it.
Me, okay. So this is a based on a true story, in inverted commas, about a former stripper, played by Rebecca Hall, who has had enough of her local scene in Florida, decides to move to Las Vegas to become a cocktail waitress. And when she finds out that that's just not going to happen, she finds herself pushed in the direction of a local gambler called Bruce Willis. No, played by Bruce Willis. He's not called Bruce Willis. That would be ridiculous.
He's called Dink, which yeah, is called, not called, le- much Less ridiculous.
Yes. I think he probably should have been called Bruce Willis, probably. For the purposes of this review. Yeah, so, and she's basically got to go and do runs for him, take the money, and work the phones for him, because he's got to be stuck in the room looking at the betting lines all the time, and then having other people go out and do it while he's still concentrating on all the betting lines. So she gets drawn into this world of gambling in Las Vegas, and that's the basic setup of the film. Mm-hmm. It's a comedy, supposedly.
Kind of, I yeah.
Tone wise, but not one I would describe as laugh out loud funny. I think it's more generally amusing.
It's more generally watchable. Mm. I think it starts a bit ropey. They have this whole pre-credits thing where it sets up Rebecca Hall going to Vegas and quitting a stripping job, and she's like having a drink with her father, and she's like, I think I'm going to go to Vegas to become a cocktail waitress, and he's like, yes, I think that's a good idea.
Brilliant idea, yeah. And they hug.
Yeah, it's a very weird tone to start
off with. That sort of sets up that you're not in a serious film when you've got that. Yeah. Did you get a Sofia Coppola vibe? Because it starts off with like her going around to a couple of guys' houses and doing lap dances for them. Did you get a Stephen Dorff Somewhere vibe from those lap dances?
I didn't, but I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would have changed the beginning. I probably would have just had
her ending up in Vegas, turning up in Vegas.
Yeah. Pretty much like maybe like a confrontation with the guy she was stripping for, and then her kind of like giving it to
driving
him,
straight out of town.
Yeah.
Oh right, yeah. Because it's apparently in the casting of this, Frears told Rebecca Hall, "You are the last person I'm looking for, and I will never cast you in this film."
Wow.
And the sort of people they were looking at were Reese Witherspoon's, the sort of like blonde American preppy sort of names, more obvious sex symbols than Rebecca Hall, who's an attractive woman, but she's not the first name you think of in terms of pinup material.
Yeah. I think it took me a while to get used to Rebecca Hall in this.
It's a departure.
Yeah, I mean, she like kind of twirls her hair around, which really annoys me, and she kind of acts as if she's like 15 years old and horny for like most of the film, but I think I eventually got what she was trying to do with the role, like, because the characters she's playing is very conceited.
Yes,
and that's the
and
point.
Also very conceited, kind of slutty, yeah. in that she'll jump from one bloke to another rather alarmingly quickly, not in the sort of like she'll play them all off against each other, but she's not the hardest woman to get into bed, let's just put it that way. And for me, I always thought, because with Rebecca Hall you're used to like searing portrayals of depression with like Red Riding or sort of complex psychological stuff like The Awakening.
Please give and kind of more inhibited.
Yeah, and when she does comedy, like Woody Allen, Vicky Cristina Barcelona, she's more the straight man. Mm. So to see her, Bruce Willis is the straight man in this film.
Yeah.
And to an extent, Joshua Jackson. And she is the film. It's that character is the film, and everything lives and dies on her. And I did actually quite like this overall, because I did find it amusing. I think you do need to know a little bit of American sports knowledge to get some of the jokes, and you do need to know about gambling, because it doesn't try and explain it assumes you know about gambling.
I think it makes it seem interesting and exciting at the beginning when she like initially stumbles upon the job. It looks like an interesting job that you'd want to have, but
way to pay off the student loan.
but I don't really think it does enough with it. I don't know. I think it kind of has all these peripheral characters that don't really do anything, like
Vince Vaughn.
I think Vince Vaughn's quite good in it, but I don't see the point of his character. Just annoying me.
He's more of a plot point than anything else. But I like Vince Vaughn when he does little things like this. Like he did Blackpool about 10 years ago, and he plays the agent who comes in. He's so, I'd never liked him in anything, and then that bang, okay, and that sort of made me get Vince Vaughn. So from then on, I was okay with him. But so when he comes in and just plays these brash, outlandish, over the top people, as opposed to his usual leading man comedy things, which I find quite dull. I think he's more suited to the zanier, more outrageous characters.
Yeah. He's very larger than life.
What about behind the camera then?
What Free Is?
Free Is, the way it was put together, that sort of stuff.
I think it's a bit busy. Moves around a lot to where her boyfriend Joshua Jackson's living. That kind of whole aside with her kind of betting ring in New York, and then it kind of flits
with John Carroll Lynch.
Yeah. And then it kind of flits to back to Vegas, and then it flits to the Caribbean, and I just think it's a bit all over the place.
Yeah, it's not a streamlined, honed. It's not a focused narrative.
No,
let's put it that way. But it does. With that, it does skip along. And I suppose the question then is if it skips over too much stuff as it's skipping along.
I think it's just a classic example of it's like you could watch it on TV easily, but I just don't think it really does anything.
No, that's the thing. I liked it. I enjoyed it while I was in there. I think it's a good film, but it is thoroughly underwhelming. The end is really standard.
I have no idea where these characters are going after it's ended. What's going to happen now? I have no idea. Because she can't stay. She can't stay with him because she always wants something. You know, she always wants a hard life, doesn't she?
Yeah, or somebody else would come along and sweep her off her feet, as she's portrayed in the film. I think it was... I think we were on the opposite sides. I think I was more responsive to five-year engagement. I was more responsive to this than five-year engagement. You're probably the other way around.
Yeah. We have to disagree sometime.
Well, yeah, that's the point. That's the whole point.
What did you think about Catherine Zeta-Jones? Second week in a row.
Thank you for asking that, because I neglected last week to say how atrocious I actually thought Catherine Zeta-Jones was. I thought she was awful in Rock of Ages. So given that, I actually thought she was... I actually liked her in this, and I didn't think... I thought she was fine. But if I hadn't seen Rock of Ages last week, I might think she wasn't doing that much, or...
Well, she wasn't doing that much. She pouts through most of it. But,
Yes.
I think... I admire her humour, like with the surgery thing, because surely she's had surgery and she's still playing that character.
Yes. Yeah, I think I think you've got to have that mindset. The Dolly Parton mindset. It takes a lot of money to look this cheap. What a great line that is.
And Dolly Parton's next week as well.
Right.
Joyful Noise.
I heard a song on the radio. I heard a song, new song with her and Chris Christopherson on the radio yesterday.
That's from the film.
Is that from the film?
Yeah, it might be getting submitted for the Oscar. So.
Oh, it's not a bad song.
Mm.
Not a bad song at all. Given the genre. So,
What do you think about Stephen Frears? Because I'm worried.
I'm less worried than I was before the film because of Sherry and Tamara Drew. I think this is... better. I think it's tighter. I think it's better, but I think in terms of tighter, I mean it's just it does what it says on the tin more. And
what has he done though?
I mean
what are we counting High Fidelity as a high point?
Because
I wasn't huge on The Queen.
I was. That's The Queen for me is probably my favourite film of his. Dangerous Liaisons is probably the biggest name film
I really
he's got on the resume.
Dangerous Seasons. And My Beautiful Laundrette. It's great.
Oh yeah, that's more of a cult thing. It's not very widely seen, but those who have seen it really respond to it. I think if you'd asked me straight away after The Queen, I would have said, if you were talking about the best British directors over the last 20 years, it would probably be between him and Lee, Mike Lee, and Mike Lee would win quite comfortably.
Right.
Whereas I think now he is kind of with these sort of, like, it's almost like Woody Allen syndrome in a way. Not that I like Woody Allen, but it's, there's people who like him think this, that it's these kind of follies in a way that he's just churning out now, and they're not substantial, and they're fluffy and frothy and don't really do much, but, and they're not supposed to be serious films, and so if you're trying to take him seriously as, like, one of the best filmmakers, it's hard to do that when he's making films like this.
I think this is more encouraging, definitely, than Cherry or Tomorrow Drew.
Yes.
So shall we get on to our actress finale?
Yes. So because for the recent past, Rebecca Hall, for me at the very least, has been quite comfortably the best actress under 30. She hit the 30 mark a month ago, something like that. Very recently. And so we're going to run down our top three actresses working today under the age of 30.
Now, I haven't like scoured the globe for these, but I try to pick actresses where I've seen at least three films that they were great in. So that's the basis. And it's sort of most promising going forward.
Yep.
Were you the same?
I was more kind of in that I wanted them to have multiple top end performances. Mm-hmm. So I wanted stuff that was in and around my top 10 of a year at least more than once. So I wanted multiple really good performances. Yeah. But it's hard. If you do it that way, for me it's difficult.
Yeah.
So do you want to go we'll do it like last week, one after another. Do you want to go
first?
Because I might steal one of yours, I'm not sure.
Really?
Possibly, I don't know which way you've gone.
Okay, well, my number three is Emma Stone.
Right, I actually,
Not many films, but I just think she's brilliant in Easy Air, brilliant in a limited role in Crazy Stupid Love.
She's good in that, yeah.
And just... around the media circuit as well, I just think she's a really exciting presence and definitely somebody to look forward to in the future.
Yeah, she's a good comedian. She's good in Adventureland, and that's not Adventureland, Zombieland. She's good in Zombieland, and she's fine in The Help.
Yeah, she's fine.
Anchors it nicely. So yeah, she's a good little actress. And now I had a lot of trouble. My first two were very easy for me, and then I had a real lot of trouble getting for the third spot. Mm-hmm. And so I'll tell you the sort of people that I was thinking of. And the sort of people who were on the shortlist were Anna Paquin, who turns 30 in about a week or something. And that was because but there's just so much time gap between being good. I couldn't really go for it. And then there was Scarlett Johansson, who was good 10 years ago, or 8 or 9 years ago, in a few things, and then hasn't done anything since. She's done so little since. I can't put her in.
Since Match Point, nothing.
I didn't even like her that much in that, but yeah, nothing serious really after that. So I was really umming and ahhing, and I might be stealing one of yours, and I apologise if I am, because I know you do like this actress. I'm gonna go for Mia Wasikowska.
Okay.
And the reason is kind of cheating, because the main reason I'm going for her isn't to do with films. The main reason I'm going for her is in Treatment, where she was absolutely super.
Yeah, she was
Just brilliant. And everybody's good on In Treatment, so in that respect it's a kind of that. Yeah, so what, she was good on In Treatment, Lissa George was good on In Treatment, actually Hope Davis was really good in Treatment. Everybody's good in Treatment, but then she's been in enough other things where she's been good, not necessarily outstanding, but she was good in The Kids for a While. She's good in That Evening Sun. She's good in Jane Eyre. So I'm gonna put her in, but I don't feel wonderful about it because my main thing isn't a cinematic thing.
Yeah. But how old is she?
She's like early 20s. Oh, she's good in Restless, but I mean it's an awful film.
I had her on the shortlist.
Right. I thought you would, because I know you really liked her. You liked her more than I did, than Jane Eyre.
Yeah, I did, yeah. She's like 10 or 12 of the year for me. I had... Mm-hmm. Who else did I have on the shortlist? Olivia Thirlby.
Yeah, I considered
her. Greta Gerwig, Felicity Jones, Jennifer Lawrence. That's about it. So number two, you're not going to agree with me here.
I think I know what's coming.
Go on then.
No. Just get my reaction. Go, say it.
Ellen Page.
Oh God, no! I wasn't
thinking, thinking Keira?
No, I was thinking Kerry Mulligan or something.
No.
Okay.
Ellen Page. Just because I think she's given three amazing performances in Hard Candy, Juno, and Whip It.
Eight minutes and 27 seconds. That's how long I lasted into Hard Candy before I turned it off.
I think it's a record. I think it's really bad.
No, it's not a record.
But it's really right wing. But she's just absolutely awesome in it, I think. Like, the only person, the only actress to wrestle a Critics' Prize off Helen Mirren in 2006.
That was hilarious.
Some Iowa film critics or somewhere.
Yeah, and the very fact that when it's not as if there weren't other absolutely brilliant performances from name actresses that year as well. That's one of the strongest years. The strongest years. Which makes the Mirren sweep even more random.
Yeah, weird.
But yeah, so then I suppose you're thinking Juno and...
And Whip It, which I loved.
Yeah, Whip It, and not Inception then.
No. Well, she's not bad in Inception, but the character's terrible.
Yeah, she's the whole point of that character is to tell the audience what the internal strife of Leonardo DiCaprio's character is. And this is kind of why, this is why I say, mention Christopher Nolan when I say you're treating someone like a 13-year-old, because that's the sort of thing. Just in case anyone was wondering.
I heard she's really good in Super, Ellen Page as well, but I haven't seen that.
Right, mine, you'll probably have heard the films, if not the girl. My number two will be Inez Efron.
Okay.
Who is an Argentinian actress. She's in XXY, which is a film about a hermaphrodite who goes off her medication. That was submitted to the Oscars in 2007. It's an extremely good film. One of the better ones from that year, which is a good year in its own right. And she just pops up in these films every now and again. I go to a Spanish film festival every March in Manchester. I saw a couple of films of hers there down the years. A film called Lovely Loneliness, which is just a beautiful little performance. She's like got obsessive compulsive disorder. She always has to go into hospitals to get checked up on stuff. Very cutesy little film. She's really good in that. And then there's another one, The Fish Child, which is very, very. And then she has these little tiny roles in Argentinian films that get international distribution. So she's always interesting. Always delivers a good performance. And she's my number two.
Good. I wouldn't know who she is, but
no,
I will watch.
We've heard of. Have you heard of?
Yeah,
XXY?
I have. Yeah.
Yeah.
People say it's really good, so yeah. I'll have to check that out eventually. Number one might be a bit of a surprise to you, I don't know. It is Anna Paquin.
Oh, you went for Paquin. Yeah. Okay. Well, I know you really like Margaret.
Yeah, I thought she was amazing in Margaret. The best actress performance of last year, in my opinion. And
it's up there for
the
me.
Piano, obviously, a long time ago. The Squid and the Whale. Yeah,
I love her in The 25th Hour. I think that's probably behind Margaret, that's my favourite performance.
Well, I haven't even seen that, so
yeah, exactly, so get on that. She's she's jailbait schoolgirl tempting Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's her teacher.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, what's not to like in that situation?
She likes the jailbait roles. You've got Squid in the Whale, Margaret. I've seen some of True Blood. I thought she was good in True Blood.
She's good in True Blood, and she can act. She can. She does a really solid job anchoring some horror films as well, like in the early part of the decade.
I just really hope that she gets more film roles, because Margaret was 7 years ago or something. It was filmed. I'm struggling to think of what she's done in film. So she's been involved with True Blood, but she could have done films as well, and she hasn't.
There's a nice little indie film she's in called Blue State, which is about this guy who's going to Canada to get out of Bush gets re-elected, so he moves to Canada as a protest. It's the lad from Road Trip, the one who wants the tape back in Road. Breckenmeyer, is that his name?
I don't know. Anyway, I know who you mean.
Yeah, she's in that. She's quite good in that. She's quite seductively crazy.
Very nice eyes.
Yes. And yeah, mine, no surprise to any listeners of this podcast.
Oh god.
Deborah Francois.
Okay.
She's been in three things that she's been really good in. One is The Child, Darden Brothers. One is The First Day of the Rest of Your Life, which is, I think, a really crowd-pleasing film, which a lot of people would like if they actually, if it ever got shown anywhere, or put on TV, or made available on DVDs. It's just a really, really good little crowd-pleaser. And The Page Turner, that was one, I think it's 2006.
Yeah, with the piano teacher who's mental.
The older one. Yes, Catherine Froh, and that got a lot of awards attention in France at the time, and it got shown in Cineworld. I saw it at Cineworld. So, and she's actually, I think, under 25. So I've been using, well, Rebecca, because this was so much easier 5 years ago. This topic for me, because you just went, well, Sarah Polley, Zhang Ziyi,
Rebecca Hall. Once those went.
Especially Polly, I mean, it's very few who can touch what she's done dramatically on the CV. And then as soon as they went, Rebecca Hall was just the easy void filler. And so now, this is, well, it's a struggle. So I always used Deborah Francois as the best under 25, and then whoever else was the best under 30. Mm. And so for me now, that you've got to change this again in a couple of weeks, then when Paquin turns 30.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's like a month or so. I actually had a look. It's closing in on it.
Oh god. We might have to revise this list next year when Kira does War and Peace.
Oh my god. I thought you were gonna say a remake of Gone with the Wind. She's gonna be going trawling through all the old Viv Lee classics.
Oh.
Who wouldn't want to see that?
You?
Yes.
You never know. Come on, keep the faith. Anna Karenina, best film of 2012.
Yeah. Well, Jude Law for the win at the very least, by the look of it.
Okay. So we have a blog. Who knew?
We do.
Move.
Anyone who's listened before and got to the end, which is probably about 7 people.
Yeah, moveforpodcast@blogspot.com. We have a Twitter, moveforpodcast, and we're on iTunes.
And the latest episodes will be on my blog.
Yes, in the moveforblog.blog.co.uk. And they might be on mine occasionally, ultimateaddict.com. And next week, what have we got next week? Friends with Kids?
Next, yes. The Sister's Sister or something?
Yeah, is that even playing?
I think so. I'm not sure. Okay.
And we have Spider-Man.
Yeah, we're going to delay it by a day so that we can see Spider-Man and on the Tuesday and have the review for you on the Wednesday. And we're also going to be having then...
Killer Joe?
I was going to say our half-year awards.
Yeah.
Yes, it is next week, yes. So, but it's not going to be several categories deep and with five nominees. It'll be a top five of the year so far.
And best in each category then, so far?
Yes. And then, the main categories.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that'll be an exercise in barrel scraping.
I think I'm alright for the acting. The top five might be barrel scraping.
Yeah, I think the top five for me is basically anything I've given 4 stars.
Okay. If anybody's got any questions, send them in.
Suggestions.
Comment on the blog post on the Move for Podcast blog. All right. Yeah. Are we done?
Yeah, we're done. I see.
Are you looking forward to Spider-Man?
Vaguely. Vaguely. That's timely, you picking Emma Stone with Spider-Man coming out.
Do you think she'll have much to do?
No. No.
That's not bet on
no.
it.
No. No, I think the biggest challenge will be looking blonde convincingly.
Go back to red, Emma.
Remember how we used to party up all night? Sneaking out, looking for a taste of real life. Drinking in the small town firelight.
Pabst Blue Ribbon on ice.
Sweet 16 and we had arrived. Walking down the streets as they whistle high, high. Stealing boys' cars with the senior guys. Teacher said we'd never make it out alive. There she was, my little.